Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Anna. Oh my gosh. Today's episode is so good. We're joined by journalist and all-around badass Mariana Van Zeller. We talk about her life growing up in Portugal, how she fell in love with journalism, how she literally pounded on the dean's door at Columbia University in order to get in. And it was worth it because she met her spouse there and they make documentaries together. And now she has a show on Nat Geo and Hulu called Trafficked. It's an amazing episode. Y'all will love her just as much as we do.
Stay tuned.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pets? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hello, Anna.
Hi, Shireen. How are you?
I'm okay. I've had a weird week, but I'm happy to be recording with you again. Yeah, it's new day, new recording, you know?
Yes, it's another Thursday. We record on Thursdays. Mm-hmm.
Usually Thursdays,
we always record on Thursdays. Mm-hmm. Even before we left.
Oh my God, you're right.
Thursdays. It's just because Thursday is it's like the easiest day. It's like the least I have to do.
I do associate Thursdays with recording, to be honest, now that you mention it.
Last Thursday I got suspended on Twitter, as I do on Thursdays. Thursdays are when I get suspended on Twitter for doing nothing. Uh-huh. And I'm back on, so that's always a journey.
It was interesting that it happened right after we recorded with Kevin, the episode that just came out.
Yeah, it always happens that way. Twitter does not care for me or my hot takes of not really that hot take. No hot takes at all. Yeah. They just don't like me.
I'm glad that your Twitter is back, and I don't know. I've been really excited to talk to this guest. We booked it a while ago.
We have a great guest today.
I will give shout outs to the person that got us connected. Someone that follows me and the podcast on Instagram, Shaheen Ja. I'm not sure if that's his actual name or just the handle he goes by, but he sends me great links and resources all the time. And he was like, yo, my friend would be great for your show. I would love to see this collab. And I was like, yes. I looked her up. I was immediately sold. I want to know all about her. And there's no better way to get to know someone than to invite them on your podcast.
Yep. It's how we make friends.
Yeah, that's the only way to make friends these days. But without further ado, let's bring her in. It's Mariana Van Zeller.
Hi.
Hi, welcome.
Hi, we should say who you are. You're a Portuguese journalist and correspondent. You've done work with the National Geographic Channel. You've done work with Current TV, which I don't think Current TV is around anymore. Are they still around? Yeah, no,
they are not.
That's too bad.
They are not.
Well, first of all, before we get too into the tell us about your life portion, how are you doing these days? How has your work been affected by this whole year?
You know, we've been filming for the second season of Trafficked, my National Geographic series, since July. Mm-hmm. So we spent about 3 months locked in the house, working on basically finalizing season one. And then it was time to go again. You know, the whole series is about black markets. And one of the interesting things that happened during the pandemic was that there's been an actual explosion of black markets around the world, partly because of the economic downturn, people trying to figure out ways to make money for their families, you know, and bring back food. And so we realized early on that it was sort of more relevant than ever to do a show like ours. So we've, we've been traveling and filming and thankfully staying safe and healthy at the same time.
Yeah. We definitely want to ask you about the show. It started last year, correct? In like December?
Yeah, we started working on it 2 years ago, but it premiered finally this past December. And
that's
it's been
how it
a
goes.
Wild ride. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it's interesting how timely it was, though. The fact that, like, you're right, it's like there's a huge uptick in all of these the black market underground schemes that people do. And yeah, we've definitely been seeing a trend there. So You knew it was happening. Yeah. You knew it was happening.
For sure. Even when it comes to the vaccine, you start seeing news pop up about black markets for vaccines. Mm-hmm. Or if not black markets, people trying to jump the line, which drives me crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was reports that they were concerned that the mafia would get in. Well, I mean, they probably have gotten in on the vaccine game in some way, but like that would be a disruption. Like they're already waiting for the mafia, which is like, wow, okay.
For sure, people getting scammed, being sold something that they think is a vaccine and it's not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of that is already expected to happen and happening.
It's just so unfortunate that there's evil people out there that will capitalize on desperation in like an unprecedented time. Like part of me wants to humanize them on the other side, being like, they're also desperate. They're also XYZ, whatever. But it comes from such an inhuman place and like, I don't know. It kind of trips me up, to be honest, when I really deep dive into the mentality of it all.
Yeah, I know. Especially about something that sort of touches us all, right? Mm-hmm. Which is this pandemic. And knowing that the more people that are vaccinated, the better it is for all of our health. And finding out that people are, you know, selling these fake vaccines that's really depressing.
Yeah. Well, on that depressing note... How about we rewind a little bit? We both read about your life a bit and it's fascinating and we want to hear it from the source. But let's start first with, tell us where you were born, where you were raised. Yeah, let's start there. Little infant Mariana.
For sure. So I was born and raised in Portugal, which is actually where I met Shaheen, who connected us all. And I went to an English school there, so that's why I speak English badly. And then I decided I wanted to be a journalist when I was 12 years old. I used to watch the nightly news with my family, and I find these anchors on Portuguese television the most fascinating people in the world because they just knew everything about the world. And I had no idea they were reading from a teleprompter. Mm-hmm. So I just thought they had the biggest brains in the world.
Yeah. You're like, and they're oracles.
So, oh my God. Yeah. I mean, how can they possibly know all the sort of, you know, numbers of Chinese economy and the deaths happening in the favelas of Rio or whatever it was? And I was like, how do they memorize all this stuff? And how do they have so much knowledge? So I wanted to be like them. Mm-hmm. So 12 years old, and I told my parents, this is it. I want to be a journalist and I want to go to Columbia University because I've heard they've got the best journalism school. And I thought everything was going to come easy. And obviously it doesn't always. And so I went to school at college in Portugal, graduated from with a degree in international relations, and then applied for Columbia University. The first year I didn't get in, the second year I didn't get in. And the third year I sort of flew to New York and I knocked on the dean's door and I told him, you know, why I wanted to be a journalist and why I wanted to come to that school. And he sat me down, he spoke for an hour, and that year I was finally accepted. And that was sort of the beginning of my career as a journalist, or the real beginning, because I'd worked at a TV station in Portugal before that, but working on a travel show, actually, mm-hmm. which was sort of depressing in its own way.
That's cool. You were like, excuse me, sir, I feel like I am being overlooked. And little did they know that they were overlooking you. That's amazing.
Yeah. You know, it's strange in this, especially in these global pandemic times, but face-to-face usually always works better. And I realized that. I was like, they discourage international students from flying and visiting the school. But all they know about me is my writing. And apparently my writing sucks because they haven't accepted me in the past 2 years. So there has to be some sort of other impression that I have to leave on them. And, you know, it taught me my first big lesson in journalism, which is, you know, determination and tenacity sort of pays off usually.
I was going to say that perseverance is something, first of all, so respectable and so inspiring because you were like, I deserve to be here. You just don't know it yet. And it definitely isn't like a component of being a good journalist, right? You continue to persevere. You want to seek out the truth. You don't take no for an answer. So yeah, it all makes sense, really. I love that something that you wanted as a child, like you've manifested into reality. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's something that I still nowadays realize how important it is, that sort of perseverance. Mm-hmm. Right after Columbia University, I spent 3 or 4 years as a freelance journalist, part of which I lived in Syria. And the same thing. I mean, you know, you pitch your first stories and nobody gets back to you and nobody knows who you are. And a lot of times it was just about, you know, there was one time at least that we flew. It was me and my husband at the time. We were freelancing together. We were boyfriend and girlfriend at the time. Actually, I met him at Columbia University for journalism as well. And we both flew to Boston to meet these people that we wanted to sell our story to. And they had no idea who we were. And we called them and we emailed them. They didn't answer. We called them. Finally, somebody answered the phone. And we were saying, hey, did you get our story? I think it's a great story, all this. And they were hesitant. And we said, actually, we're going to be in Boston tomorrow, which we had no plans of being there. We're going to be in Boston tomorrow for an unrelated thing. We'd love to meet you in person. And that's really what sold the story. Like, we met them in person. We were able to pitch it, you know, face to face. And they gave us, I think it was $2,500. I think it was the first check that we received to go and do a story together. And with that money, we bought a camera, sort of a semi-professional camera, and went to Brazil and shot our first story together. Yeah.
Wow. Again, with the in-person hack, you know how to get them in, you know, like, you're like, it worked before, it's going to work again. Let's go see exactly. Them eye to eye. They can't say no.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, meeting your husband at Columbia, that's all kind of, it was meant to be. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. It was. It almost didn't happen. I was taking a photography class at the time, and there's something, we have the Halloween party at Columbia, and I was dressed as a black angel, and there was a friend of mine who was dressed as a white angel. And I had my Polaroid camera that I had with me at Columbia every day. And I take Polaroids every day, you know, the typical student thing. And I asked this guy that was passing by, hey, do you mind taking a photo of me and my friend? And he was like, sure. And he takes a photo. And you know, it's a Polaroid, so it takes time to develop. And as it's developing, because I was taking my photography class and I thought I was the most brilliant photographer in the world, I can see that there's like huge headspace. And I stop him and I say, hey, sorry, can I just tell you something next time? Not so much headspace. And he looked at me, was like, can you wait until the photo is fully developed? And then I see that the halo for my black angel costume is like perfectly positioned at the top of the photo. And he remembers perfectly thinking, well, I thought she was cute, but definitely never want to date this bee. She's unbearable.
Wow. But then we did date. That is such a good meeting story, an origin story for a relationship. I love that. You could see that like in a movie even, you know? Yeah. That's amazing.
It worked out.
Yeah. But then you have to realize, like, if you had gone into Columbia the first or second time, you probably wouldn't have met him, you know?
I know.
It had to be that third time. It's crazy how the world aligns that way.
100%. And you know, it was the year 9/11 happened. So it sort of jump-started my career as well, because I was the only Portuguese journalist in Manhattan at the time. And so I'd worked at this Portuguese television station before I came to New York. But yeah, just 3 weeks, more or less a month after I arrived in New York, 9/11 happened. And I got the call from the station saying, hey, we need you to go midtown to the top of this rooftop of this building and do the sort of live reporting on the events of what's happening right now in New York. And it was, I had zero live experience. I'd never done anything of the sort. I was 24 years old, super young and inexperienced, super nervous. And that whole day, that whole experience, that whole week of reporting on it totally changed what I wanted to do in terms of journalism.
So they took advantage of the fact that you were out there and were like, you're our correspondent.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly. I've seen recently the footage of me on that day, and I'm wearing way too much makeup, like blue eyeshadow and a ridiculous like nylon top. It looks really the most unprofessional, you know, everybody around me. I was surrounded in this rooftop by all the people that I'd grown up watching on television, sort of my, you know, my heroes. And here I was with a ridiculous eyeshadow and a bright white nylon thing, looking ridiculous and really nervous. But I did my job. I was able to put two words together, which till this day, I don't know how I did it considering how nervous I was. And then I remember sort of the moment where I walked down onto the streets and I started seeing the first people holding signs, looking for their missed one, for their loved ones, and realizing pretty early that day that, okay, the kind of reporting that I want to do is not so much this sort of live fast reporting. I really want to sort of contextualize the news and understand why events like this happen. Right. And so a year later, I moved to Syria.
Honestly, Middle Easterners in general, I think at that time, desperately needed news that wasn't distorted. Immediately after 9/11, Middle Easterners were demonized, Muslims were demonized, and there wasn't any turning back from that narrative in the media. So I really admire that you saw that event and you're like, I need to dig deeper. I want to get to the root cause of this. I don't want to sensationalize it. I just want the truth. I really admire that.
Yeah, you know, it was fascinating. I decided on Syria because I wanted to be close to the action. I wanted to learn Arabic, which is incredibly hard. And it turns out actually Damascus was a party city. So I skipped school all the time. I partied most of the time. But I did meet some amazing people. And one Syrian guy who became a really good friend of mine, and he started telling me, look, in my little border town, there's all these Syrians that are crossing into Iraq to fight against the Americans. And there was nothing that was being reported in the press at the time about the jihadis at all. I mean, it was Iraq had been a huge success. Saddam Hussein had been toppled. The West was winning. And so there wasn't much information about this at all. And I was like, wait, what? There are Syrians crossing the border? And why are they doing this? And this seems so strange. And he said, look, I'll take you there to meet my friends because they're sort of hometown heroes now. The ones that come back are heroes. And yeah, I'll take you and you can spend time. The only problem is that you can't say you're a journalist. We have to go under the pretense that we're trying to learn more about the region and more about Islam.
Yeah.
And that's when my then boyfriend, now husband, actually came. He was living in Argentina at the time and he came to Syria. And I was telling him about this story. I was like, wow, let's do it together. And he was a print journalist. I wanted to do television. But he agreed to sort of, we went and bought a little camera with the Syrian carpet business that I was running, where I shipped carpets to my mom in Portugal. She would sell them and then send me back the money. Right. So with that money, we bought a little camcorder and went to the border and did our first story. And I think one of the most surprising things to me that has really, again, defined my career as a journalist was realizing that even these people that we completely consider to be the enemy were like us. They were a lot more like us than we'd like to admit. Guys that I spent time with, in particular, one that I would never forget, who was sort of the clown in the town. You know, all the kids adored him. As soon as he walked out on the streets, the kids, he was surrounded by kids. He was funny. I could understand a little bit of what he said because I spoke a little Arabic, but not fluently. But even through that, like I could tell that he reminded me a lot of my friends at home as well. I remember one day that he got on his knees and he serenaded me with a Celine Dion Titanic song.
Oh, nice.
That even though he didn't know his word of English, he knew this song by heart, every single word.
Of course.
And it was a moment for me. It was like, wow, I can relate to this person so much. I know that if I was probably, you know, if he was born elsewhere, we would probably be friends. And that became a really important part of the reporting that I do, to really try to humanize people, even those sort of at the edges of our society.
That's what good journalism does, really, right? I don't know. We need journalism that does that instead of like doing things that sensationalize or like further shapes this narrative about marginalized communities versus like actually try to understand the reasoning or the truth behind it.
Right. We need journalism that does, you know, like real critical thinking about the situation versus like what we get now in the mainstream media, which is like, this is what it is. Okay, bye. And you're like, we need more. And this is not doing the stories any justice without any context or any even remote warmth to it.
Like, you imagine if the journalists that report on the Middle East go to the Middle East for a while and like then like it would shift how they operate. Like they can also be understand like, oh, these people are just like us, like you said. You know, it's unfortunate that like the majority of news or media doesn't really take that into consideration. Like it kind of further others people instead of trying to humanize them or like even attempting to be like, they're just like us. That would be like never something that's said right now in the news. But let's take a quick break first. But when we come back, I'm just curious about your time in Syria because I love Damascus. My parents went to Damascus University and I visited growing up all the time. Obviously not since 2011, but I want to talk to you about it and we can talk about traffic and so much more. So stay tuned. And we're back with Mariana Benzeller. Your name is so cool, by the way, to say. I feel cool saying it. You have a very cool name.
Thank you. You know, I have a son called Vasco, which is a Portuguese name, a very Portuguese name, after the Vasco da Gama, the Portuguese explorer.
Yeah.
And how cool would it be if it was Vasco Vanzella, right?
Oh, so
cool.
That's really cool.
Unfortunately, it was a fight I didn't win with my husband, and he's Vasco Foster.
Your husband was like, remember the halo? Remember the halo?
Exactly. You owe me.
Vasco Vanzella. He sounds like an action star.
Yeah.
Totally. Or a porn star, which would be really awkward.
Yeah.
Depends.
Either one, you know,
could go either way.
Maybe in a perfect world. But okay, so you talked about your experience in Damascus at the university, learning Arabic and stuff. I really admire that you had the initiative to even want to learn Arabic, by the way, just to further understand that region. And also, I did read that some of your documentaries have appeared on like PBS and a bunch of other channels. I want you to know that my parents and every Syrian person I know is so appreciative of those programs that like go deep dive or like even show the Syrian side of it all. So I didn't realize that like, oh, this guest that we have on, like she's part of that. So I, first of all, thank you.
Thank you.
Was it 9/11 that kind of made you interested in the Middle East coverage or what was the motivation behind going to Syria?
Yeah, I think with 9/11, I realized that the Middle East was going to be a very important part of the world in terms of shaping the world and world events and the news. And as a young freelance journalist, you know, thirsty for knowledge and also to be at the center of the action and to be, you know, reporting on relevant information. Yeah, I realized, okay, if this is it, I have to move to the Middle East and obviously we'll want to learn Arabic. Can't go to Iraq because that was where the too much action was happening, you know, the war, and I had no money or protection or anything. And so, yeah, so Syria was the obvious choice for me. And it was fascinating at the time. There was a bunch of things that I wasn't expecting. Like there was this very small, but sort of united community of foreigners from all over the world. They're interested in the Middle Eastern culture, interested in Arabic, which I loved. And then I remember that my first few days there pinching myself and thinking, I have spent all my teenage years and before I left for New York vacationing in sort of the same place in the south of Portugal. And that's what I did every year. And I was like, why didn't I just like figure out a way to fly to Syria and, or, you know, it was the realization that there is like a massive, incredible world out there that I had yet to discover. And that was so outside of, you know, the traditional Western world, essentially, that I was used to, Portugal and then New York. And I really like completely fell in love with it very early on. But, you know, there was a problem with being a journalist. We were living in a Christian family home with a beautiful interior courtyard. It was beautiful, but this was before cell phone times. It had a little phone to make phone calls. I'm trying to think if it was before cell phone time. I remember using this home phone a lot and we having to be very careful with our words.
Yeah.
We couldn't say anything bad about the regime. We couldn't even name the president or anything. So it was even when I was speaking to my family, being very careful with what I said. And I remember even emails being sort of concerned about it, what I was saying. And even my closest friends there didn't know I was a journalist. So I was there to learn Arabic and I wouldn't even tell them that I was looking for story ideas, essentially, and trying to figure out a way to become a freelance journalist in Syria.
That phone thing is so real. I remember being in Syria all the time and even my grandma being like, the walls are listening. Don't say anything bad. Even if I said Bashar's name and I'm like, oh, fuck him. She's like, no, you can't say that. You know, like,
I know.
Don't say it.
That the even scares me
everything.
Now.
It's like it's like a police state. It's so, I mean, we've both talked about how garbage of a regime and how garbage of a person he is. So come at me. I don't care. But I mean, maybe I'm a little bit scared just for I don't want to put my family at danger, but I guess there's already damning stuff out there already. But yeah, it's a controlling police country. And I remember a couple years ago, Bashar and his wife had this whole like Western European tour where they were like interviewed by like Gail, I think, or Oprah or whatever, or like maybe Diane Sawyer. I don't know. But it was like, wow, look how progressive they are. She knows, she went to university. He was a doctor. Like, and it just enraged me because they were further presenting this front of equality or treating their citizens well or whatever. So I'm glad you know the truth.
They did that same thing with MBS for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, they would be like, wow, young progressive leader in Saudi Arabia. And you're like, I don't know about that. More like power hungry rich kid who shouldn't be trusted. But okay, they really do. They try and humanize these figures that like, it's like you. All you had to do was Google a little further to see the damage they've already created, or like how they treat people around them or their citizens. And it's like they don't do that. They don't create that context. It's just like, wow, cool young person in charge, and you're like, what?
It's like no,
yeah. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, like the same people that watch. I mean, that's the thing. Like an Arab or Persian family can watch a program and a white family can watch a program, and that can be their first introduction to that culture. And they can absorb that information completely differently than the marginalized communities can, or the people that are being represented can. So I don't know. That's just, it goes to show again, like how important like fair and balanced news reporting is and journalism is. There shouldn't really be a bias so much as like, this is what's going on. You know,
yeah, I mean, boots on the ground, right? Old school journalism.
Yeah.
And that means, you know, commitment and time and organization, much like right now with Nat Geo, which is their dream partners to work with, because they are willing to put that commitment and time and money behind some of these long form documentaries that aren't easy to produce. And a lot of them, you know, are risky and they involve spending time on location, which I think, unfortunately, and at least in terms of sort of news and news departments around the world, there's definitely less of a will to do that or to put the money behind that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. How did your relationship with Nat Geo start? And like, how did that, I mean, it seems like a very good rapport you have with them, but how did it kind of come to be?
I was working at Current TV, which was Al Gore's television station at the time. And that was the first sort of network that I worked at, and I worked there for 7 or 8 years. And then we had done a documentary, my husband and I, called The Oxycontin Express, which was about the beginning of the opiate crisis. This was back in 2008. And we won a Peabody Award and we won a Academy Honors Award. We won a few awards. And in every one of these awards ceremonies, we kept on seeing these people from Nat Geo, the same group from Nat Geo that worked at the time. They were the executive producers of this show called Explore, which is one of the longest running news magazine shows in the world. And so they came up to us and said, hey, we love your work. And is there a way that you'd want to work for Nat Geo? And I was like, what? Yes.
Yeah.
I had literally said, I think sort of the day before something in conversation with my husband about how, you know, if you tell me one place that I want to work at, it's National Geographic. That would be like the bomb. Like I wouldn't believe I would die the next day. And yeah, they approached me and I was very pregnant at the time. I was like 7 or 8 months pregnant. I mean, it was super fast. And then suddenly a few months later, that was it. They hired both my husband and I. We worked on Explore for a few months and then we worked on another show. And then sort of things changed at Nat Geo. We got offered other positions elsewhere. I worked at Fusion for a little bit, which was ABC's and Univision's brainchild. And then I mess up my English all the time. My friends make fun of, I cannot get an English expression right.
You speak English better than I can.
I know, but I say things wrong all the time. Like don't put Jenny in the corner instead of Jen. I don't know.
That sounds right to me. I don't fucking
nobody put. Yeah, I know. I basically mess up expressions all the time. And then Nat Geo reached out to me again three or four years ago and said, you know, we're starting to do Explorers again. Would you like to do some? And I said, absolutely. Come back as a correspondent for Explorer. So that happened. And then after a while of seeing my work at Explorer, they approached me and said, hey, we're actually thinking we really like what you do, doing sort of a whole series around just your work. And so pitch us some ideas. And I did. And yeah, now here we are working on season two.
That's incredible.
How was it when you won the Peabody Award? Because oh, that yeah. is really amazing.
Oh, my
goodness.
You said it so, like, just casually. Let's definitely go back to that.
It was crazy. I was actually in Palm Springs with my dad, who had come to the U.S. to visit me. And we had taken a little, like, four-day vacation. And my husband was back in L.A. working. So he got the call. And then he called me and my dad answered and he told my dad and my dad told me as he was crying. So there's a scene of my dad like crying with tears coming down his eyes, super emotional, like he won a Peabody Award. I was like, what? Get out of here. He's like, yeah, you won a Peabody Award. And I start crying and I call my husband and we were both crying. It's surreal. I mean, it was totally surreal, especially this documentary. It had been such a hard work. It was almost a year and a half of work for myself, my husband, and this other producer called Sarissa, who was incredible. It was the three of us. You know, I edited the doc, most of the doc, with another editor, but I was actually editing part of the doc. It was like so many nights up until 3 a.m. It was a crazy amount of work. So it was really our baby. So then to see it recognized like that amongst incredible other work was totally, totally surreal.
Yeah, it must have been a dream to just like, it's also something, I mean, I love that your dad was like on the phone just breaking the news. It's just,
I know, it was good.
I love it.
And the best part was when I went up on stage, I think it was Al Gore was at that ceremony too. And I was, again, super pregnant. I was like, so pregnant. It was the photos of that. That's the only bad thing was that the photos are ridiculous to me with my Peabody and a belly that goes from the east to the west coast. And I'm up on stage and I do this speech about that. My whole team is with. So Derek, my husband's there and the whole team is there. And I do this speech about how I name every person. Thank you to the producer, Sarissa, da, da, thank you. Da, da. And then I saved my husband for last. And I said, and thank you to the sexiest man alive. And I can say that because he did this to me. And I pointed to my belly. It was funny. It was super romantic to be up there with him and be pregnant of our first child.
I mean, it seems like you guys have a great relationship. I really like it. But I was going to say earlier, like, I really love that you literally manifested like something else for yourself. Like you manifested like the day before you're like, Nat Geo, I want to work for them. The next day, hey, it's incredible.
Crazy. I mean, I obviously had had this dream forever, but it was like funny that I'd just been talking to my husband about this. And then we meet them. And then a few months later, we're actually working there, which
was
amazing. Crazy. Yeah.
What made you interested in that subject matter in general, the black markets and everything?
I think it was a little bit of that experience in Syria, actually, realizing that there are these black markets that are operating and happening all around us. And then after that, actually, we went and lived in Brazil and did stories very early on drugs. And I'm really fascinated by these worlds because they have a huge impact on our daily lives that we're not aware of. I think it's almost half of the global economy is actually under these black or gray markets, and yet we know so little about them.
Yeah.
And they have a big impact on our world. And they operate sort of in plain sight many times, which is something that I discovered early on. And then this wanting to humanize the people operating, you know, the criminals, the most stereotyped and stigmatized people in our society. So that's a big part of it. And yeah, when we started filming 2 years ago, exactly. And it's nonstop. We filmed for about 3 weeks for each episode and then about 6 weeks of pre-production before we even hit the road. And then it's like 3 or 4 months of edit for each episode. So all of the episodes are sort of working in tandem, but it's nonstop traveling. It's been really crazy.
Wow. The idea that half the world, that's unbelievable, because it's like it's so real, like everything is going on literally behind closed doors, but it's so much has moved. Capitalism is such a frustrating thing because you're like, oh, it's praised, but you're like, it's such a dark thing. There's so much going on behind closed doors that we are just not privy to, but like have a sense of because of like documentaries like yours or documentary series like yours. And it's
The drug business alone, which is crazy, brings in, I think it's over $300 billion a year, which is more than companies like Walmart.
It's lucrative.
Insane. Yeah.
What if that's on, like,
if you think,
I know. Thing, like, what was that? And where would I get in on that?
Yeah. And I can connect you guys to a few people.
Yes, thank just you. Oh, no.
Kidding.
What was that? That was our end goal this whole time. Being like, let's bring her on. She can put us in touch with the right people.
Yeah. So, okay. So I saw that you also worked on something called Obama's Army.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little about that, what that project was?
Yeah, I was at Current TV. It was, again, my husband and I, we did a story. President Obama was, before he was president, he was running for presidency. And it was when he was attracting the massive amounts of youth that weren't usually involved in campaigns at all. And we realized, oh my God, this is such a great opportunity. We were working for Current TV, which was a youth oriented channel.
Yeah.
And we were really sort of fascinated by what, you know, who these young kids were, some of them too young to vote even, you know, like 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds who were, you know, sometimes even opening rallies for Obama. So we thought it was really interesting to sort of get down on the ground and meet some of these people and see how they were organizing and what was so sort of revolutionary about the way they were campaigning. And it was super interesting. We filmed them going canvassing. We filmed at a rally where Obama spoke and, you know, electrifying crowds. Yeah,
that was interesting to me because as I was reading it, I was like, it reminds me so much of like Bernie's campaign. And like, because like back then it felt like there was such a like positive light on it versus like kind of when the Bernie socialist movement came through, it got like not a great treatment by mainstream media. Like it was almost kind of portrayed, you know, it was like, well, of course it was like the Bernie bros and the bullying and all that. But it was like a very interesting, it really made me start thinking because I was like reading about that. And I was like, it's such a weird dichotomy of like just the shift. Like we were all so excited for Obama. Mm-hmm. But the second we just wanted to be like, and let's take a further step left, they were like, shut it down. No, thank you. You've gone too far. And I was like, we're right there on the edge of like true change. Like Obama was like change, almost like just verbally saying change. Now we're actually like taking the step to change. So I'm very obsessed with what happened between the Obama era and like today, like the complete flip of society of like, you know, how we just basically went so right because everyone was so, you know, so horrified by a black Muslim president, which, you know, obviously was just like the right wing pushing that the Muslim show your birth certificate bullshit. But like, it almost like shakes me to my core of like, why we can't move beyond like this sort of establishment Democrat place we're at. Like we just can't, they won't let us. And it's very, make a documentary about that. so I can understand it. I feel so stuck.
I should call it Bernie's Army.
Bernie's Army is intense though on the internet.
There is 100%. There's enormous parallels between the two, between the youth involvement in the Obama campaign and the Bernie campaign for sure. Yeah.
I mean, I'll be the first to like, I love Bernie. I was really like, he made me feel hopeful. I still love him so much. It's like one of the only good politicians out there. But it is interesting that like what Anna was saying, Obama was like the like surface level, like just the word change, right? And then when he didn't do anything too drastic, really. He did a couple of great things. He the most drone strikes ever, though, you know what I mean? But then Bernie's whole thing was like, let's actually change. They're like, nah, let's go back to something else.
Like, that's radical.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay.
Okay, let's take our last break. And we will be right back with more Mario. And we're back with Mariana Van Zeller. I'm curious, actually. I don't know. I don't mean to rewind a little bit, but what is it like working with your spouse or your boyfriend turned spouse on this stuff? Like, how do you guys function as a team when you approach this kind of material?
Well, now we're actually not working as close anymore because 10 years ago, we had a child and that made things really difficult for us to be traveling at the same time. But we own a production company here in LA together called Muck Media. And we're the ones we produced Trafficked for National Geographic. We produced, my husband directed actually a documentary called Science Fair, which if you guys haven't watched it, you should. It's so good. It's okay. The best. And so we sort of, we run a business. We have three other partners and we talk about work all the time, but at least we're not traveling together all the time like we used to. And it was good. It was good. We had a great time. Our honeymoon was actually spent. So we got married in 2006 in June. Oh my God, he would kill me. He thought I was hesitating on the date here. In June of 2006. And we didn't have time to go on the honeymoon. So our honeymoon was actually working, covering the Hezbollah Israeli war.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's a
in
beautiful
Lebanon
honeymoon.
And Syria. I know. We actually, it's really our happy place anyway, both my husband and I. Being in the field reporting is really where we feel most alive anyway. So, wow. You know, it didn't take anything away from us. But 4 years later, we decided, okay, it was actually after working so hard on the Oxycontin Express, we decided, we need a break. We need to go somewhere where we don't need to be thinking about work. And we went to India and that's where we made our child. So I keep telling my son, you know, you were made in India. So once at school, they were talking about diversity and he was saying, well, I'm half Portuguese and half Indian.
Oh, no.
Like, really? How are you half Indian?
Because I was made in India. It's like, exactly. Oh, now everyone knows in class confusing. That my son was conceived across the globe.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
That's Mom, really can you explain that better? Yeah. We get along really well. I think we complement each other really well, my husband and I. You know, I'm very outgoing and he's sort of more shyer than I am, but he's really sort of smart and analytic and is always like deep thinking things. And I operate mostly from instinct and spontaneity and go, go, go. But we kind of complement each other really well.
That's awesome. I feel like a job like this can definitely make or break a couple. So it's nice that you guys work together.
It really is helpful because we do spend so much time on the road, both me and him. One of us always is usually home with my son, but the other one is traveling. Like my husband right now is traveling and I'm here. Mm-hmm. But it really helps. We don't resent each other. You know, we know exactly what that means and what, you know, if sometimes we go a full day without talking to each other, we know exactly why that is. You're super busy in the field. You're completely engrossed by the work you're doing. And, you know, sometimes that call comes really late at night or sometimes it's just a text, hey, exhausted, going to bed. And we don't fault each other for it.
Mm-hmm. So from the beginning of your relationship, when you started working together, like, did you realize like most of your interests were in like kind of like this black market sort of drug trade? Because it looks like a lot of your work kind of focuses in on that. Like, did you guys realize you're both like, hey, have you ever thought of this black market?
I think so. I think it was always something that I was drawn to. You know, these are some of the darkest and most secretive corners of our world.
Yeah.
And as a journalist, I think you're always drawn to the things and that people tell you are impossible to gain access to, or I definitely am. And also to the places that are, again, have an impact and yet we know so little about them. It's shining a light. That's what it's all about. Right. So why not shine a light in some of the darkest corners of our worlds? And so we've always been drawn to it. And I think we realized, both him and me at the same time, because we started working on these stories together, that we, you know, the things that would scare other people or make other people uncomfortable, it's always a tough thing for me because obviously I don't want to say, oh, I'm not scared of, because I am, because there are moments where I am, but I feel comfortable in worlds that sometimes I think other people aren't. So I've always been sort of drawn to that as well.
Well, that's good you found a partner who's also okay with that. Because I feel like it could probably be very scary in those corners.
Well, now he doesn't work with me. So now it's me and my team. And I'm always considered the crazy one in some, they're like, well, we'll do what she says, but are you sure this is safe? Yeah. I think there's always like a struggle in my mind, basically, yeah. between curiosity and fear, and curiosity usually wins.
Right.
And sometimes that's not a good idea. So I always have to calibrate myself and turn to my team and say, hey guys, you guys think this is okay? And if everybody thinks it's okay, we all go. But even if it's one that doesn't think it's a risk worth taking, then we don't. Basically.
Yeah,
that's good.
It kind of feels like the time when you did work together was a really crucial time. Like, he came from Argentina to Syria. Like, you needed that backup. He came, you know, at this point you're good. You're like, go on a trip. I'm good. You know, like, I think the
100%.
Relationship has kind of organically grown into what it is. And but that's the dream, to have a partner that is on your, like, understands what you want to do, mm-hmm. is just as curious as you are, so you can respect when they go and they can respect when you go.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Especially being a mother, you know, I get asked a lot, you're a mother and you do this kind of work, I mean, what happens to your child? And he never gets that question, which of drives course. Me crazy.
Yeah.
And to have a partner who really sort of respects my work, is my biggest fan, number one, you know, mm-hmm. he's the first one. You know, every time I do anything on stage, I've spoken at a few events on stage, and every time, like, I look at him and he's like, he's not a very emotional person, and he's always super emotional, which is the sweetest thing. He always gets like teary eyed, and it's the best. Yeah. And the same for me.
Started, I mean, so it all started with you.
Uh-huh.
Not being like
bitch, essentially being
I love
a bitch
that.
Too.
I really, it gives me hope for any type of romance. I'm just gonna get into an argument with someone and see where it goes.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's good that you have, like, there's not someone who's being like, are you out of your goddamn mind? Mm-hmm. You're like, yes, I am, but that's where it comes from. That's how I find the good stuff.
There is a great story that I tell sometimes about, there was one time that I was with the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico, and I was about to film. I was trying really hard to film this fentanyl drug lab.
Yeah.
I've been reporting on opiates for the longest time. And finally they told me that I was going to be given access, but they wouldn't tell me what time they'd show up. And then eventually they said, okay, we'll show up in the middle hours of the night. We'll give you a call. You'll come down. We're going to mask you, put something over your face, blindfold you, take you in a car, and take you to an undisclosed location. And I called my husband and said, Darren, so this is what's happening. They're going to do that. And, you know, what do you think? He's like, great. Make sure they film that. They're filming you when they put the blindfold over your face. When the cameraman is filming you as you're being blindfolded.
That's hilarious. Exactly. Wow.
And that's
this is
how
why
you know.
Yeah. And the moment you're like, you're the one. I know. Like, you know.
He's producing. He's like, we need that footage.
I love that.
That's
wow.
Also, that sounds like a wild ride. How did that go? I need to know more about this. So they blindfolded you and took you to their location?
Actually, you know, I waited in my room, all dressed, fell asleep in my bed, totally dressed with a phone right next to me, and waited. It never happened that day. And then I think it happened a couple of days later where we were taken, but there was no blindfold needed. And it was actually in the middle of the day, but we did get to see sort of a fentanyl lab, and it was fast. And then for traffic recently, it was middle of the night, and we filmed another fentanyl, a much bigger fentanyl lab, with the Walter White of the Sinaloa cartel, who was really sort of the Breaking Bad character, who is a biochemist and one of the biggest, you know, drug chemists for the Sinaloa cartel. And it was intense. I mean, we had to wear full hazmat suits. You know, they told us that if we'd inhaled, if I took the mask for a second, that we could have died, overdosed instantly just from the fumes.
Whoa.
Super intense.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, fentanyl is a very deadly drug.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is that like when you meet like a Walter White type character? Because you're like seeing them. I never understood that. Because like when you watch these documentaries, their face, you know, blurred out, their voice distorted, whatever. You hide their identities. But like, what is that relationship with meeting them in person? Like how they just have, you just have to create this trust that you're not going to create any problems for them?
It's the most challenging part of our work, for sure. It's, you know, for every yes we get, for every access we get dozens, if not hundreds of no's. And so it's really, and it takes sometimes a lot of meetings, a lot of in-person meetings. It's what I call the underworld first dates. mm-hmm. that first meeting where they want to meet just me or me and my team. And they just want to get a sense, essentially they're afraid that we're law enforcement. So they just want to make sure that we are in fact journalists as we say we are. So it's, you know, they're drinking games sometimes. There's a lot of cigarettes that we smoke. You know, they usually, you know, it's like the best way to break the ice is either share a cigarette or share a drink with somebody. And so there have been lots of occasions where it's been like long hours. And then at the end, they're like, okay, we'll give you a call tomorrow or we'll send you an address or meet me here. And then you start filming and it's again, they're a lot of times are nervous. So it's, we show them exactly what they look like on camera. We make sure that they're okay with it, that they, you know, even if part of their eyes are showing that they're okay with that, because that's super important, not only, you know, for their security, but ultimately for our security and ultimately for the security of the local journalist, who's a lot, we call the fixer in our world, who a lot of times are the ones giving us those contacts.
And they're putting themselves at risk, you know, they're probably the most at risk because the minute you 100%. Leave, you know,
100%. They're the unsung heroes, I always say, of our industry. Yeah. They really are the ones that are, you know, willing to share their stories and their contacts with us, and then the ones with the biggest risk. Yeah, because we have the privilege of coming back home and they stay there. So we have to be very, very careful that we, you know, disguise faces and voices.
Yeah.
Wow. That is next level. That's terrifying. You see it in movies and shows and you're like, what? But then talking to someone who's done it, that's wild.
But you know, the amazing thing is that behind that mask is the majority of the time is a completely normal person, like a father of kids. You know, this guy ran a business, a completely legal business, which I can't say what it was, but it was sort of in the same sphere. And he had, and people would, he had clients. He was like, he was known around town. It was a normal, nobody knew. And sometimes not even their families know what they are doing. You know, we interviewed this guy who was doing printing fake money by hand. He would finish these beautiful $100 bills in Lima, Peru. He was like one of the most sought after finishers, as they call them, that make fake dollars. And his family didn't even know. He was a driver by day and a counterfeiter by night. And nobody knew what he did. It was pretty incredible.
Sounds like Netflix series.
Yeah. But like, that's the thing. In these shows, in Netflix or anything else, like, they don't really depict them as normal. They kind of, there's always a touch of like a big house. Like, they have a lot of guns or a weird mustache. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, they're always mustache, a caricature of what you think is sneaky and evil or something. And so I think it's important to remember, like, no, he has a family. He's got into this business for XYZ reasons, you know. I humanizing them, regardless if you agree with what they're doing, is important because that implies what their motives are. And that's more fascinating to me than like the industry they're in. It's about it's the human behind it that fascinates me.
Yeah, because if you realize, and I think it's the message of this show, that in a lot of cases, it really is the lack of opportunity that leads people to these black markets, not everyone. And that doesn't mean at all that we're condoning what's happening at all, obviously. But if you try to understand why it's happening and why people are turning to black markets, then you really get to the root of the problem. And then you're able to sort of start to address it and try to prevent these black markets from happening.
Wow. I mean, everyone go watch Trafficked because I want to understand more. And it's, I don't know. I'm not done with the first season, to be honest. So I got to make it through. There's too many things to watch. But you've motivated me to be like, yeah, this is really interesting and I need to keep going. But thank you so much for being on this show.
Yes, thank you.
You're incredible. You're so just, your work is so important. I hope you know how appreciated it is, not just to us, but like to the audience that watches it. And hopefully more people watch it that just like are like, oh, what's this? And they click on it because that's the people that really I want to get through to, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you guys. Really appreciate it.
I have one more question for you, which is, what part of Portugal are you from?
I'm from a small seaside town called Cascais, right next to Lisbon, which is the capital.
Oh, okay. Okay. I went to Portugal once.
Really pretty.
And so I was curious. And you said you vacated.
Where did you go?
I took a bus from the top to the bottom. So I think we started in
the Algarve.
Yeah, we went to the Algarve. That was an interesting place. Very British tourists.
It depends on where you go. You know, there's beautiful areas in the Algarve that haven't been overtaken by the Brits, including a town where I got married, actually, which, you know, there's plenty of beautiful places in the Algarve. But there, yeah, unfortunately, there are many towns where they don't even, you know, speak Portuguese.
Yeah, I feel like I landed in a very touristy area. We were in like Albufeira.
Yeah, that is the epicenter of bad tourism in Portugal,
no.
Unfortunately.
Okay, that's good to know. I've never been to Portugal. I've always wanted to go. Hopefully, I don't know, in 5 years.
Hit me up. I'll give you the tip.
Yeah,
I'll give you the tip.
Now I know.
100%. I'm going to hit you up immediately if I go. It's just like, give me the deets. Where should I go?
Don't 100%. Google where to go in Portugal. Because it'll take you, like, I went and I was like, okay, this is just a tourist trap.
Sorry.
That's okay. It was fun. It was a nice trip anyway. I went in a time where I was very into drinking port. So I was like, I have to go to Portugal and drink some port. And it was nice, you know? I enjoyed my trip. I thought Lisbon was just absolutely beautiful. Like, truly, like, a romantic city. I was like, I should fall in love here.
Yeah. I know. Lisbon is beautiful.
It was the port speaking mostly.
I need to go see Portugal. Yeah. I can't wait. I'll let you know. So don't forget me in 2 years when you travel again.
Yeah, I will not. Definitely.
Okay, before we let you go, please tell our audience where they can follow you on social media, where they can watch the show, how to keep up with you, and plug anything you want.
Okay. The show is Traffic. It's a National Geographic series. It's now airing actually on Hulu and also on the Nat Geo channel around the world in lots of different countries and here in the United States. Season two coming up in a few months. And you can follow me on Instagram, Mariana VZ. And Twitter as well, Mariana VZ. And Facebook. And don't have TikTok. The chagrin.
Can you imagine,
of my
like, son. If you made the shift to TikTok and you're like giving these, I mean, honestly, you might do well there,
like,
because
dancing.
They like this, like, underground kind of, like, guess what? You're wrong about this.
Oh, 100%. My son is constantly saying, Mom, I mean, really? You can't call yourself a real journalist if you're not on TikTok.
Oh, God.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, he's not wrong.
So in the future.
I think we're going to have to take advice from the kids. You know, we're going to have to, like, at a certain point, we're going to have to take their word. Even though he said he was half Indian, he's forgiven. This has been so great. Thank you again for coming on the show. I'm so glad that Shaheen made the connection. Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. I'm so grateful for that.
Sure.
So thank you.
Thank you.
You're
guys.
Listening. Very much appreciate you. And I'm going to close this out. Thank you again, Mariana. You're a delight.
Thank you, Shaheen. Thank you, Anna.
Yeah. Yay. Okay, this is Ethnically Ambiguous. It's Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I'm Shireen, it's Shirohiro on Instagram, and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm at Anna Hosni on Twitter. Not suspended, but we'll see, because I tweeted about Palestine yesterday, so we shall see how they feel about that.
Okay, thanks everyone for listening, and until next time, watch Traffic.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.